Welcome to Happily Family. I'm Cecilia Hilke.
And I'm Jason Hilke.
And we're delighted today to have Dr. Daniel Siegel with us. Dan is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine and the executive director of the MindSight Institute. He has authored or co-authored many books, including several about parenting, including Parenting from the Inside Out, The Whole Brain Child, No Drama Discipline, Brainstorm, The Yes Brain, and The Power of Showing Up. Welcome, Dan. It is great to have you.
Thanks for coming back again, Dan.
Great to be here with you, Cecilia and Jason. Really, it's great.
I wanted to ask you about something. I'm going to summarize something that you said. I'll put in my own words. But you basically said in one of your talks that I watched recently that in order for our kids to like really feel felt, that it's not just about seeing and responding to their behavior, but it's about also responding to their inner thoughts. And I want you to talk about, like, what did you mean by that?
Exactly. Well, you know, it's raising a child is really one of the most challenging things in the world. And a simple way to think about it is that your child has externally visible behaviors that we have to make sure they're physically safe. We need to feed them, you know, take care of their bodies, which is great and fundamentally important. And so this is not or, it's and. They also have a mental life, a subjective experience of feelings, memories, perceptions, thoughts, hopes, dreams, longings, desires, all of that and more we'll just call the mind. Now, when we say the word subjective, what we mean is inside of us, we have a felt texture of life called subjectivity. It's the essence of what the mind is. And so when a parent, research shows, focuses on that subjective life of their child can learn to understand their own internal world. That's called insight. And you're also teaching them that the internal world is important so that they also have an invitation to develop empathy and compassion, because with empathy, they can feel another's feelings, understand another person's point of view, to really imagine what it's like to be the other person. And if the other person is doing well, they can have what's called empathic joy. If they're suffering, they can have empathic concern, which is a gateway for compassion, which is when we feel another person suffering and say, wow, I sense you're suffering. Let me think about how I might be able to help you feel better. And then I do something to reduce your suffering. That's what compassion is. So insight, empathy, and compassion are teachable skills that get taught when a parent focuses on the inner nature of the mind itself.
And so knowing that there's all kinds of different stages our kids go through, at what point is that, is it like appropriate age-wise to start doing that? Is, you know, how early and maybe even how late? I'm sure it looks different between the span of ages too.
Absolutely. Well, Jason, you're right. You know, depending on the child's age, you would have what we can simply call reflective dialogues. Dialogue meaning a conversation, reflective meaning you are taking a moment to pause and explore as a reflection what's actually going on. So let's take, for example, a one-year-old. You know, the studies are very clear that the more we talk to a child, even at 1 year of age, the more a child is going to develop their linguistic abilities. So you can say to a child, for example, who has experienced, something upsetting, you know, they at one, let's say they've started to cruise around or maybe even are walking and they fall down, you could help them get up, and that's great. And you could also say, that must have been scary, you know, when a dog barked and so you lost your balance or something like that. So you're using words to start naming, oh, that may have been scary, the internal world. And when we can name it, we can frame it. We can put it in a picture and understand it. And this framing process is a part of what's called narrative. It's how we tell stories about life. And amazingly, you know, for about 20% of the population, they aren't taught these inner skills. So what I call mindsight, they aren't taught that the skill of insight, empathy, and compassion. So the world is just external. And if you get to know a person like that, it's quite striking how everything is about the externality, the physicality of things, not about what did something feel like? What's the emotion behind a behavior? What does something mean? What's your frame of mind, you know, called a state of mind? So in all these ways, you know, when you have reflective dialogues, you're reflecting on the internal nature of mental life.
Okay. I just real quick, I want to say, yeah. I kind of like the name it to frame it.
Yeah.
I heard you slip that. I haven't heard that one before.
No, I just made it up because actually it was interesting. You know, years ago, a study came out at UCLA actually showing that if you put a person in a brain scanner, you show them a very upsetting photograph, their brain gets all activated as it's responding to this emotional expression. Well, if you ask them to name the gender of the person that they're seeing in the photograph, nothing changes. But if you ask them to use their linguistic centers to name the emotion they perceive in the photograph, the whole brain reaches equilibrium. So those researchers didn't have a name for that. So I just named it, name it to tame it. And that's for years I used that. But then someone who has a background of being African-American, she came to me and she said, I find that very assaulting to use the word tame because my ancestors were slaves and white slave owners, and you're a white person, tamed my ancestors. So I don't actually feel comfortable with the phrase name it to tame it. So I said to her, my gosh, this is a part of my white privilege. I really hear you. I asked a number of my colleagues who are Black if it bothered them. It did not. But it bothered her. And that was enough for me to say, let me think of something else that rhymes that is equally as powerful. And so I thought of name it to frame it, with the idea that you put a picture in a frame and you can see the whole scene there in front of you. And that actually feels better than taming it anyway. But I certainly don't want to create a racial attack or anything that makes people feel uncomfortable. The idea of the phrase is to be empowering, not to be belittling. So I'm fine with the new phrase, name it to frame it. And you could say name it to reframe it if you want, but if you haven't framed it in the first place, you're not really reframing it. So then I thought, take off the re and just make it frame. And then, you know, with these pictures, you know, my mom is recently moving into independent living. We brought all these pictures and she takes the frames and really does create a story in the different parts of her new apartment where, you know, she wants to tell a story. And the person helping us, you know, put up the frames, so interesting. He would ask about each of the paintings because my mom used to be a docent at the art museum. So it was really beautiful to hear her tell the story of each of the paintings and where they came from. And it made me feel good about the phrase, name it to frame it. So, yeah.
And which goes right along with what you've talked about, like making a story. It's so important for us to be able to create the narrative about what's happening for us and for our kids to be able to create that narrative, and how great that is. What a great analogy of using the pictures and framing them to create that narrative or that story ourselves. So I really appreciate that that analogy. It's great. I actually like name it to frame it, maybe even better. It's nice. Well,
exactly. Cause even taming it, you know, was a nice rhyming thing with, you know, emotions that are out of control. But it also had the connotation like, oh, emotions need taming rather than just framing. So I'm, you know, I'm happy to be open. I mean, it's like, you know, like the creation of the word mui happened, you know, one of my students came up to me and she said, you know, this talk you're giving really pisses me off, really makes me angry. I said, okay, well, what makes you angry about it? It's called me to we. And I said, what bothers you about that? She goes, well, you've always said that it's important to maintain a me while we are also being a we. I said, absolutely. She goes, well, the phrase me to we implies you're letting me go and only becoming a we. And I go, oh my God, you're right. I didn't think about that so clearly as you're pointing it out. And she said, well, come up with something else. So I said, okay, how about not only me, but in addition, create the relational we. She goes, well, that's what you're doing, but that doesn't rhyme. So then I said, okay, well, if integration is what we're doing, it's maintaining the differentiated parts and linking them without losing their individual essence. So me plus we would be we, I said to her, and she cracked up and she said, that's it. So that's where it got created. And soon around that time, actually, it was really funny. Another student of mine came up to me and she goes, I am so confused by you. And I said, what's confusing? She goes, I saw your name spelled out. And I said, okay. And she goes, but I thought your name was Dan Siegel. I said, my name is Dan Siegel. And she was from the Lakota tribe. And I said, my name is Dan Siegel. She goes, no, I thought your name was Dan Siegel. I said, my name is Dan Siegel. Did you hear it?
Yes.
Yeah. What did you hear?
The seagull, like bird. Like
the bird.
Well, dance, eagle. Oh,
that's even better.
Oh, I did.
Yeah. Nice. Dance, eagle. So that's my new name around here at home. That's my new nickname, Dance Eagle. So, because I used to be a dancer, you know, so.
I knew it. Anyway, that's
the background stories.
Dance Eagle is a lot better than Dan Siegel, like the bird.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a good one, too, Cecilia. That's nice.
Better to be the eagle than.
Yeah. Well, no, seagulls are okay.
Okay. So we got a little sidetracked, but it was super fun. So I want to come back to the Mui thing. But first, I wanted to ask about we talked earlier about like how we can help our kids soothe, name it to frame it, helping them with it, you know, making a narrative for their experiences. Another term that you've used before is relational experiences can help the kids soothe. What's a relational experience and how do we do that?
Well, that's a great question because, you know, like at this moment, you could say, okay, Cecilia's there with a body, Jason's there with a body, Dan or Dance is here with this body, and there's three people. You go, okay, well, that's pretty obvious. What's the big deal? But then you could say, well, but then there's a relationship among the three of us that isn't so easy to see with your eyes. It's not so easy to hear with your ears or even to touch it with your skin, right? But it's equally as real and just as important, if not even more important. And these relational connections we have, you could define them as the way we share energy. And one subset of energy is when energy is symbolic, like if I say hello, and that's called information. So energy and information, they change over time. We call that flow. So energy and information flow is what's shared in a relationship of any sort. And, you know, for example, this is not the first time we're meeting. So we have a history of sharing energy and information flow. And in this body called Dan, there's a positive feeling because every time we get together, we laugh, we have fun, we explore stuff that we are all finding meaningful. And then this time we have together ends. So there's always a positive feeling in the beginning, the middle, the end. And then when we get back together, like this time, you know, it's exciting to be here. So that's our relational history. Now you can't see it with your eyes, but it does get stored in memory and you can describe it. And experience always means energy flow. Relational experience would be the sharing of energy and information. Now, some families, like we're saying, never reflect on the inner aspect of that flow, and they're only looking at behaviors, not at mental life. So they're not having reflective dialogues in those relational experiences, which include patterns of communication. And actually, what's really striking about thinking about it this way is it's this simple. It's kind of amazing. I wasn't taught it this way, but when I was trained to be an attachment researcher, people would just say, you know, patterns of attachment, patterns of attachment, patterns. And I go, a pattern of what? And they go, what do you mean? You know, it's a pattern of a relationship. I go, well, what's a relationship? So no one would define it. So I needed to go like to the most basic thing. And maybe it's because I don't think I'm a reductionist, reducing things to their fundamental components. But amazingly, if you do that, then you actually expand out and you start seeing the larger systems view, which is to say that a child that's born into your family, you know, isn't just, and I'm trying to think of the poet that said this. Oh, Khalil Gibran, who used to date my grandmother, It's another story. You're getting all these family stories. But so Khalil Gibran in Greenwich Village used to date my grandmother. But in that view, he has this great poem about, you know, the child is not yours. It is a temporary time when the child is on the journey with you. But, and I forget the poetic way he said it, but it's this beautiful way of articulating that the system in which the child exists, he didn't use the word system, but is much larger than just the family, certainly much larger than just the skin and case body of the child. So it's a way to begin to think beyond just ourselves as nouns, but begin to think of ourselves as verbs, because a relationship is a verb. See, it's a process, it's an unfolding, it's a set of events, it's a sharing. And then you go, whoa, I'm not just a noun, I'm a verb. And that begins to shift how you live. And then there's some really interesting implications of that, not just for your family life, but how your child will grow and develop and be a part of, you know, the planet itself.
So how do we start shifting our own dialogue about me being a verb in the context of our family also, and relate to our family, like our family is also a verb. How do we start shifting those conversations?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a conversational shift. Exactly, Cecilia. I think the one way to think about it is, you know, at a very basic level, as parents, you know, we can have fixed ideas that are noun-like things we grasp, like you are supposed to do this with your education, or you are supposed to do this with your gender identity, or you are supposed to do this with your political views, or you are supposed to do this, you know, lots of supposed to's, which turn into concrete, which is the word concretize, which I remember once having an argument that was really wrongheaded on my part with my best friend's sister. And she was using the word concretize in an essay. And I said, that's not a word. She goes, yes, it is. I said, no, it's not. And she was absolutely right. It was absolutely a word. But I was so arrogant to say that I thought I knew absolutely the truth. And rather than say, I'm not sure if that's a word, let's look it up, I said, it's not a word. You know, that would be an example of me nounifying even my opinions, right? That they would be fixed entities. And I was completely wrong. But ironically, concretize is what nounifying does. You know, and so we can use that word because it's actually a word, and it turns it into like concrete. So the difference between how to be in a family as a verb would be to feel your opinion as a manifestation, perhaps, of a belief that has a fluidity to it, and certainly that comes just from your perspective, and that other perspectives will have their own validity to them, and that you may strongly believe in this or that, but that doesn't mean your child will. So, you know, I just went hiking with my son, and, you know, whatever I may have thought, you know, one does with one's career, and, you know, I'm a physician, my wife is an attorney, you know, we both had to make sure we verbified our life because, you know, he has in his bones, he's a musician. And, you know, as he was discovering that when he was around 11 or 12 years of age, you know, we had to say, you know, that's got to be like the hardest profession in the world. But if it's who you are, it's not like you're choosing to do that. Life gave you these gifts, and he's an incredibly gifted musician. And I got to say, he lent me, or he gave me, one of his guitars. And so I've been playing it lately. So I wanted to show him this set of riffs that I have been just, you know, stuck on. So he got into his old room, laid back on the bed, and I just started playing guitar for him for the first time ever, just a few minutes before we got on. And he just got his eyes closed, and I'm going, oh my God, what's he going to think? And he just goes, Dad, that's so beautiful. But it was a verb-like thing. There was no, I wasn't trying to become like he is, a, you know, professional musician. I just was playing at night to, you know, play music. No other reason but to be the music. But then this set of riffs came up, so I just wanted to share it with him, and I did. And he just said, that is so beautiful. You know, so that would be an example of being a verb. I wasn't doing this for any particular noun, like, you know, objective thing to accomplish. It was the joining. And in this case, as a musician, he could listen to his non-musician dad's music, and we could have energy and information flow that was not linguistically based, you know, because I don't often dance with him, although we did go hiking, you know, in nature this morning, but it could be a sharing of his own language.
You said something subtle there that got me thinking, if we are being a verb, what was it you said? You said you were, you used the word be, you said, I think you said you were being a musician or something like that. And
being the music.
That's what it was, being the music. And I thought, oh, that's like being a verb. That's like,
yes.
Versus, and so I could maybe put that, if I were looking at parenting terms, I'd like, rather than I am a parent, I am being a parent, which is interesting because there's a lot of action involved in that. And that's much more flexible. And so I'm a big fan of how we speak has a lot to do with how we act, and using it that way. If I'm careful about how I'm talking, it's interesting. It's in the same way of like my emotions, that rather than I am mad, I'm feeling mad, like that verb of how I'm feeling, like using verbs and how we're talking allows for us to become more like a verb rather than be more like a noun. It's what I'm taking away from a little bit of what you're saying, which is interesting. It's very fascinating to me because there's so much fluidity there. You said that, you know, this suddenly becomes fluid, and we have to then also become willing to change and think about who we are as we're parenting. And I think that can be challenging for parents because they think, I need to know the right way to do this. And I'm supposed to be the authority, and I'm the one who's supposed to be saying, like, here's the right way to do it and have all the answers. And that sounds very much like being a noun to me.
Exactly. I mean, Jason, that's exactly the issue. And it'd be so interesting to see how people take on this thing. Because a lot of people say, well, this is confusing to me. Am I a noun? Am I a verb? But the way you're describing it is so beautiful. And it's, you know, just to show the, I think, the incredible impact, if you start taking this on, it's like, let's take the example you said where there's anger arising in a person's experience. They use the linguistic symbols, I am mad. Now, am, as you're saying, is a, you know, derivative of the verb to be, right? As your whole identity. I am Jason, I am Cecilia, I am Dan, right? And in English, you know, it is, has a definitive noun-like quality to it. Now, there are things called verbals where you can say, I am, you know, let's see how you would do it. I am selfing rather than I am this self. It's a complicated thing, but the point of a pure noun is it has a kind of boundary to it. So if you are the anger rather than anger is happening now. Well, now the anger is softening. And now I'm seeing more clearly with gratitude or appreciation or whatever. So verbs are more able to fluidly change and don't have to concretize. They don't have to become concrete. They don't have to become solidified. The way the mind tends to work, if you can picture this, is the top surface that we share with each other are symbols, like linguistic symbols, words. Beneath that, sometimes in consciousness, sometimes not, are concepts. Like, you shouldn't have done that. I'm really angry at you. You know, and beneath that is a category, you know, you're bad, I'm good, something like that. So a category would be this deep way we divide up the world, good and bad. Concept gets derived from the category, and we express that with language. So if we start using nouns a lot in how we speak, we actually reinforce our rigid beliefs. And I think not only am I angry, but you are wrong and you are bad. And in a way, the political divisions we have now, the polarization we see, is because of these words we're using, especially on social media, that divide us rather than allow us to see we're fluid verbs and we all want to, you know, bring positive things into the world. No, we polarize And then people don't always want to bring positive things into the world. They feel threatened by the enemy, in quotes, and then they want to, you know, destroy the bad guys. You know, and this becomes then this black and white thinking that is really nounifying experience. And if we could move into this more verb-like way of being, it isn't that you become passive. It's that you become resilient instead of rigid.
That's all really fascinating. And I wonder if in a parenting example, if what we're talking about is that we can nounify our kids too, and we can adopt ideas about them. My kid is naughty. My kid is a good student. My kid is disobedient. And like, whether it's a positive expression about them or a negative expression about them, that limits them in who we see them to be and limits our curiosity about them, rather than maybe approaching a situation with our child, some sort of power struggle or something, and thinking, okay, who is my child? What is he or she showing to me right now? And how, and being curious about how could I respond in this situation? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, exactly.
Here?
Well, so let's take what Cecilia, you just said, it's so beautiful, and say, like, the difference in what you just said between a parent who says, I know my child is X, Y, and Z, versus what you did say is, right now, I'm getting to know my child. Or let's use the same word, know. You can say, I know my child, or you can say, I am knowing my child. Now, it seems subtle, but this verbal, what knowing is versus the noun know, you know, although maybe that's a verb, but you say, I know you, you know, it's like a final thing. Like, I know this, you know, the more active agent of knowing is, right now, I'm knowing you. So like, you know, our daughter is hiking on the Appalachian Trail, right? And, you know, we had to take a deep breath. She's hiking by herself, you know, 2,200 miles over 6 months. And so both her mother, my wife, my wonderful partner, Caroline, and I separately went to spend some time with her on the trail. And it was a knowing experience. We wouldn't go there to that we knew her finally, but that she's in this emergent process of being with the forest, of being on this trail, of being on this 6 month journey. And whatever one might feel as a parent about, you know, your offspring doing this hike by themselves, you know, it is a commitment to a process of, you know, doing this journey from Georgia to Maine. So in doing that, what's so fascinating about it is both of us had to really drop into the verb way of being as a parent, to show up for this brief amount of time, to share the trail with her, to know this journey is her journey. And in any way, it's a metaphor for life, that it's her journey, and we're able to share a part of it with her, literally on the trail, but more metaphorically for the life journey, this is what it is with our kids, you know? And so it's what's, I think, exciting about this noun verb thing that we're discussing is it really invites you as a parent to participate in a different way as a verb parent than as a noun parent. Because then the journey is empowering your offspring to be themselves a verb on the journey, which really, I think, is a healthier way to be, really. So you're inspiring them with your own verbification, you know, your own dropping into process that's ever unfolding. And it doesn't mean you become passive. It doesn't mean you become wimpy or not strong. Quite the opposite, actually. It takes a huge amount of an inner compass to allow yourself to fluidly move along the journey of life, being ready for whatever things unfold, including bears on a trail, you know, so that you are you know, you're ready to be there rather than say, you know, you just sit and say, I'm sitting in my chair in my room and I don't move anywhere because I was taught to be a noun and nouns can break when the wind gets tough. But if I'm a verb, I just go with the wind, you know, and I can be fluid and flexible. That's what I mean by being a verb allows you to be resilient. Being a noun can make you prone to being rigid.
Yeah. And then what does all this conversation have to do with ecology and the planet? We were talking a little bit about that before we started recording.
In terms of parenting and the experience of being a verb in presence, you know, which has these three qualities, interestingly, you know, experience of doing the wheel of awareness practice now with, you know, tens of thousands of people and having people report what the experience of pure awareness and the hub of this metaphoric wheel is compared to the rims experience of the thing you're aware of, like hearing or sight or smell or taste or touch or the sensations of your body or thoughts and memories and emotions or all that stuff on the rim. You have a practice where you move this sort of spoke of attention around there, and then you aim it into the hub. And when you aim it into the hub, and I do this every morning, you get this experience of the difference between awareness and the thing you're aware of. And then there's a whole interesting science behind it. But to say to Cecilia's question, you know, when I've done this with all these folks, three things come up that are a different use of the word cold than I've used before, but it's a sense of connection. You know, I really feel connected to my parents, or I really feel connected to my children. I feel connected to my friends, other family members. I feel connected to school. I belong there. I feel like in my identity, there's an identity that I'm a member of all humanity. I'm a member of the human family, and then I'm a member of all of nature. So when we use the word connected, it's both to people and the planet. That's the sea of coal. Open awareness is this quality, you know, where you just can be in the hub of this wheel, if you will, and just be open to whatever arises. It's really the way as a parent, we become empowered to be a verb because we can just be fully present. It's really what showing up really means. And that's the OA, open awareness, COA, and then L for coal is love. And when you really open yourself in this way to presence, you get connection, open awareness, and love. And so what's amazing as a scientist to say this is just, you know, the empirical data is in. You know, I've done this with 50,000 people in person. When people take the microphone, they report it, love comes up, not every time, but almost all the time. And I was just wondering as a scientist, like, what is going on? So I think that those three things, connection, open awareness, and love, are like three threads of a singular tapestry of life. So when you begin to raise children from that place of presence, connection, open awareness, and love is that COAL acronym for presence. It allows you then to encourage being active for social justice, being active to be compassionately supporting other people, being active to realize that this lie of the separate self that is in modern culture is maybe even a lethal lie, because that view of separation is making us, you know, race to accumulate material wealth. Let's say we run a factory and we think it's all about me. So I just accumulate more income by producing stuff that you feel you need to buy. But then I don't care about polluting the area right around my factory. I don't care about how much carbon I'm emitting. And because it's all about me and all about my bank account. That's the lie of the separate self. And the lethal lie is that a modern culture that teaches about separation makes us prone to children growing up thinking they're only inside their skin and case body. And that's such a lie that people feel restless and feel driven to try to get rid of that restlessness by accumulating things or getting addicted to things or whatever. That never works, because the true path towards happiness is our relationality with people and the planet. And when you realize that verb way of living, you get away from the noun isolation And the great news is it's going to be a win-win-win-win situation. The individual will prosper, the families will prosper, human families will prosper, and nature will prosper, because we fully have the capacity, if we go from me to we, M-W-E, where we're realizing we're in a body, but we're also relational, that's the we part, the we allows them to come together. I think we can do it. I think as parents, we're in a really important position, as teachers we are too, mental health professionals, to bring a we identity to how youth are being raised. And then we can revise our identity as adults to incorporate this integrated way of having identity and belonging, so that this sense of connection and love and open awareness is how we live our lives.
Thank you.
Yeah, we need to have a second part. I just love it. I love so much of what you just said there, for so many reasons. One, because that's part of one of our missions with Happily Family is connecting and really making a difference in the world through parenting, and how we raise our kids, I think, really can have that strong effect. So I think that's super, super powerful. And we need to wrap up for you as well. So, but as we're wrapping up here, do you have any final words or a big ask for the audience that's here?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think what you're doing is so important. And, you know, we've all been through a lot. Just raising kids is a lot, but raising kids through the challenges of modern life, and whether it's, you know, the pandemic of a virus, or the pandemic of social injustice, or the pandemic of polarization, or the pandemic, you know, of our climate catastrophe, all those pandemics, I think, are related to this issue of the lie of the separate self. So we can turn that around. We have the ability to do that. So, you know, whether you come to our website and do some of these courses or join in community there, I welcome you all to continue the conversation.
Thank you, Dan. What's the best way for people to find out about the courses? I know you have several coming up, and you have some that you've already put out. What's the best way for them to find about those and all of your work?
Yeah, we have some fun ways of really diving deeply into this material. We have two interconnected websites. One is Dr. Dan Siegel, drdansiegel.com. And that, if you then find, you know, the resources there or courses, it'll link you to the mindsightinstitute.com. So either website is a way to get to the other one, Mindsight Institute and drdansiegel.com.
We'll include links to those in the speaker notes. Dan, thank you again for taking the time. Thank you for all the work that you're putting in this for sharing this. This really makes a difference in the world. And thank you for being here with us and with our audience. And we look forward to the next time we get to talk to you.
A pleasure. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Cecilia. Great to see you.
You too, Dan. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.